Okay, am I coming through loud and clear? Now, well, I hear a little bit of an echo, so that suggests that I am. Okay, so one thing I just want to point out is there's been a concern in academia for some time about the problem of grade inflation. Well, within the pharmaceutical industry, we suffer from title inflation. So in my department of 25 statisticians, there are 12 assistant directors, about 8 associate directors, and then the rest are directors. So either we have too many chiefs and not enough Indians, or we've got inflation going on. One of the other things that I've noticed at Pfizer is, since I've been at Pfizer, I've been there about 5 years, is we seem to have a reorganization of some sort about every 6 months. And my group has participated in about 3 of those. And one of the stated goals of each reorganization is to reduce the amount of management. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen one of these reorganizations happen, but my perception is that, in fact, every reorganization decreases the number of workers and increases the amount of management. So that in this particular reorganization, all that has occurred is that several of my colleagues and I will get promoted to new management positions to manage a smaller number of people in the group. So I think this title inflation will continue. Hopefully there is some asymptote, but we haven't reached it yet.
Greg,
yes? Yes, I'm aware that it's safe. Please don't forward this to my boss. Okay, so one of the things I'm going to try to do is this talk is structured a little bit differently than most of the other talks. I'm trying not to talk about answers. I'm trying to talk about questions. So what I'm going to try to do is, instead of giving you some detailed information about a particular problem in the pharmaceutical industry, I'm going to try to explain the goals, the problem, the general problems that we have, and then to try to take, if there's time, one example, perhaps two examples, and go a little deeper. But the goal is not so much as to get you really excited about one particular problem that's mostly solved, because those are the kinds you show in these kind of meetings, right, the ones you kind of know answers to, is to give you an idea of the sort of places where we really need help, and to see if that sparks somebody's interest of saying, I know, I've done something like that in a different field, or even in the same field. So so that's essentially what this slide says. Okay, so first of all, I work for Pfizer. Unless you're into medicines and you are old enough to need a certain number of them, you may not actually recognize the name in any concrete sense. So Pfizer does human and animal pharmaceuticals and consumer products. Now that last piece is a piece that I didn't realize until I made these slides a couple years ago. So and under the prescription things there, we've got a whole variety of things. And I've highlighted this one over here, Lipitor, because this is the single most revenue-generating drug in the world. It's a $8 billion drug, last time I checked, per year. And it's been growing and it's not decreasing. So this is why Pfizer is now the biggest, because they made enough money, they're making a lot of money off of this, because it was shared with another company, the development process. So they decided to buy that other company, get all the money, and with the proceeds they then went and bought a couple other companies. There's also a large over-the-counter class of things, many of which are things that we probably never realized. Visine, Bengay, Benadryl, all sorts of things that are things that we have in our medicine cabinets, we have under our sinks, consumer products, things like gum, chiclets, dentine, trident, sertraline, all sorts of things. We used to have shaving supplies, but they got rid of that, and you can see some of the consequences. How is Viagra doing? Well, Viagra sells exceptionally well and is mostly not used for the intended purpose. So, and as a matter of fact, I get lots of spam in my mailbox for Viagra. So they obviously don't know, the people who do the spam don't obviously don't know who manufactures the compound. So, So how well are we doing? Well, we're doing pretty well. And 2004 sales, $52 billion, about 120,000 employees. However, we've had a couple problems this year. So we went from pretty well to pretty, well, actually we went, it used to be excellent, but down to pretty good, hence the need to do some reorganization. The company has some goals about revenue growth that aren't consistent with income growth, so what do? You reduce costs. And one of the questions that our job is in the research division is figure out how we can do better. One of the side notes here is awful lot of the time in the media right now you find out about how bad pharma is. But one of the things that really surprised me a lot when I got to Pfizer is how involved Pfizer is as being a good corporate citizen. It generates an awful lot of both monetary and in-kind value to the communities in the world at large. A substantial fraction of the AIDS compounds being used in Africa are actually donated by Pfizer, as well as some other pharmaceutical companies. So there's an awful lot of good being done that isn't directly involved with selling products that are good compounds. Okay, so I'm in the research division, the research and development division, and we do a lot of things. So we do pharmaceutical research and development, which is mostly involved with finding compounds and demonstrating they're safe, but there's also a lot of associated basic science, medical, manufacturing, and technology research. So my experience is that every time I go talk to somebody who is in any scientific discipline, I discover that somebody at Pfizer is doing something very much like that to solve problems that we have. We're doing fairly well as well, $7.7 billion into the R&D budget, lots of different projects, many different places, some places spread through the United States and the rest of the world for research, and I just grayed these out today for this talk because as part of the ATS thing, they're reducing the size of those sites, and the best site in the world for working for Pfizer was La Jolla, but they're closing it down. I don't know. You'd think that the management would decide to move there or something, but anyway. Okay, so what is the purpose of the research and division? So this is the official one from the website. We dedicate ourselves to humanity's quest for longer, healthier, happier lives through innovation in pharmaceutical consumer animal health products. Okay, well that's one of those phrases that says nothing mostly. It says we try to be good to the world, okay, through pharmaceutical products. So what's the practical translation? Well, our goal is to discover chemical compounds that prevent or treat disease and that minimize undesirable side effects. For instance, we know of one compound that is guaranteed to solve all of your problems. It's a mega dose of arsenic. It will solve every one of your problems. Just give it 12 hours. however, it has a very large, usually unintended side effect, which is death. So even though that is the perfect way of treating any one of your problems, its side effect is sufficient that you're not going to want to take it. So the minimizing the side effects is very important. So first of all, the division's goal is to discover these compounds. And some aspects of this are very much like chemistry in any chemical manufacturing company. As a matter of fact, Pfizer's history as a company is not a pharmaceutical company until the Second World War when they were asked to manufacture penicillin. Before that, we were just a chemical company. And if you wanted some ascorbic acid, you'd go buy it. If you wanted some bicarbonate soda, you'd go buy it. And they actually ran a little storefront where you'd go in and there were boxes of various chemicals in there. That's the sort of company that Pfizer was historically. And we still have a legacy of that within the company. Within the company, there are two groups of people who think they're on top and who fight for power. One group is the chemists who have the historical backing, and the other are the medical doctors who have the current portfolio backing. And they're continually struggling to see who's in charge. Of course, what does that leave out? Well, it leaves out all the scientists. And that causes problems sometimes. But so the first step is to discover these compounds and hopefully discover ones that have these features. The second step is actually to demonstrate this to the satisfaction of both the people within the company, to the regulatory authorities, and to the market. No matter whether you found something that's terrific and you convince the FDA, if doctors don't prescribe it, you're out of luck. And so we need to demonstrate that these things are good, both first that they're safe, then that they're effective, and third that they're practical to manufacture, distribute, and utilize, and finally that they're cost effective. So if you usually think about pharmaceutical companies, you'd probably reverse these two items here. And originally the FDA's goal was number one, that when somebody sells you something and says that it's effective, you have to prove it's effective. But the greatest burden nowadays is not proving that something is effective. It's proving that it's safe. We can find all sorts of compounds that do the great thing, but they tend to have side effects or long-term problems, etc. And so, yeah, we may smell snake oil now, but at least we have to guarantee that snake oil won't give you the runnies. We have to prove that it's safe as well, at least safe relative to the problem. So, for instance, and that there's a trade-off in there. Something that people are going to take for headaches has to be exceptionally safe. and you have to put an awful lot of effort and do very large clinical trials to demonstrate that it's safe, because the trade-off between relieving a headache and having a side effect is a very low trade-off. You want essentially no side effects to relieve the headache. And there are lots of things out there that do that now. On the flip side, if what you're trying to do is get rid of metastatic cancer, people are willing to put up with an awful lot of side effects in order to get rid of metastatic cancer. And so that ratio of what the cost of a side effect is very different. For instance, we give a lot of compounds for cancer that we know are genotoxic and that are cytotoxic and that give people every known problem. The point is that we're trying to kill part of them, just not the rest. And the rest generally gets really sick. So there's a trade-off there. And that's one of the things that actually is a big challenge. Finally, because this is a business, we have to minimize the discovery and development costs while maximizing income. So that's why they're reorganizing again. Unfortunately, we'll get more management and less workers, but, you know. Anyway. Well, there's always the trade-off that you have to charge enough to make profits, but not so much that the market won't buy it. And there's this is a thing that's in the media right now, is there's this the big concern, at least in the United States, that medicines cost too much. They talk about how the medical costs are growing, you know, essentially on an exponential curve over time, and that's a big problem. And the flip side is that if the companies can't make any money, they won't do any investments, and you won't get any compounds. And there's a careful balance that you have to do there between making things inexpensive enough that people can buy them, and yet expensive enough that companies can make money. And there's probably a pretty good balance now, but there's a whole another topic that we can talk about, those trade-offs. Those trade-offs also happen in other industries. They're not always as clear as the ones are right now for the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, so what are more specific details of our scientific questions? So we have to start with, there's a disease out there of some sort, whether it's headaches or cancer or diabetes. Okay, what is the disease and how does it work? So what are the biological mechanisms of that? So we tend to look for metabolic pathways, disease processes, etc. How do we actually determine disease status, including changes in status? So for a headache, it's pretty clear that if you ask somebody if they have a headache, yeah, they can say yes or no. But then if you're trying to figure out how bad their headache is, well, you can't swap headaches with somebody else and say mine's worse than yours. You get into challenges that are more like psychology questions in there, of trying to figure out how you evaluate headaches. But there's all sorts of other sorts of things you want to measure in order to determine whether a disease is present, whether it's getting better or getting worse, whether it's better or worse than it was yesterday. And one of the big focuses right now in the pharmaceutical industry is because the only real system in which you can test whether a pharmaceutical really works and is safe is in people, you tend to have to actually get to people before you can really prove that something works and is safe. That's expensive and time-consuming, especially if the disease you're interested in treating is a long-term one. So there's a lot of effort right now in looking for what are the biochemical or physical or imaging or any other sort of markers that we can look at to see whether this long-term disease, like heart disease, for instance, which is a big problem in North America, whether that's improving over a short enough window that you don't spend millions and millions of dollars finding out that things don't work. I mean, it's sort of okay to spend millions and millions of dollars finding out that something does work, but the other way around, you want to be able to say this isn't working and say that after 6 weeks or 6 months rather than after 6 years. So I've worked on a couple of projects within Pfizer that we actually had to kill because we couldn't afford to do the studies to demonstrate that they worked, because the mechanism by which they worked, for instance, for diabetic neuropathy. So people with diabetes tend to have much higher levels of sugar in their system than people whose sugar control system is normal. And that sugar, for reasons we have theories about but we don't actually know conclusively, has a destructive effect on nerves and destroys small nerves faster than big ones. And so you tend to lose the feeling in your extremities, your fingers, your toes, especially in your lower extremities. And that's a big problem. course, it's one of those things that take a long time, and it turned out that we couldn't measure things, measure changes over a short enough period to make some of our treatments worthwhile pushing forward into clinical trials and pushing into the market. Even though we had indications that they worked, we had good theory that they worked, we had good chemistry that they worked, we couldn't afford to run the 10-year trial to determine that they worked because we wouldn't be able to make back the cost of running the trial. And so there's a lot of effort in this biomarkers area. Another area is, okay, so we've got a disease. We can sort of measure whether somebody's got it or not, whether they're getting better or not. Okay, so what can we change? So this is called targets in the field. And generally speaking, targets are some pocket on some protein that has some purpose, whether it's a signaling protein or a cell surface protein or some enzyme that works in the cell. This is generally what most targets are. And so we have to understand the pathways, disease processes, usually we have to understand, to try to find where these things are that we can target. And then we have to sort of decide, well, that's something we can actually get at. So, for instance, one of the areas that's very difficult is in brain, is in psychological compounds for psychological disorders, because it's this blood-brain barrier. Sometimes the thing you want to get is in a part of the cell, in a cell that's in a part of the body that you can't get compounds to, or you can only get certain types of compounds to. So even if you can find the perfect thing to treat this problem, you might not be able to get anything to it. So that's one sort of problem. So which mechanisms, are the mechanisms that could be modified, and can we modify them? And can we find chemicals that will actually hit those mechanisms? So if we then find chemicals that affect disease status, sometimes we don't know how they work. So again, classic examples of that. So I guess it's about 12 years ago now, there was a sort of a revolution in the treatment of schizophrenia. It turned out that a drug that was did a poor job of mediating the mechanism we knew about turned out to be a terrific drug compared to everything else for schizophrenia. So we knew that it was doing a bad job of what we thought we were supposed to do with drugs, but it was a better drug. And the question came, why? Well, after a number of years of research, they determined that this drug, because of its particular shape, hit the thing that we wanted to hit, but it also hit something else, a different type of brain of neurotransmitter in a different part of the brain. And then, in fact, that the reason the old drugs worked is because they weren't perfect for hitting the thing we thought they were hitting. They were have a little side effect of hitting this other thing. So that we were knocking one part of their brain out, that this is the one that tended to cause tardive dyskinesia, the sort of the jiggling and problems, when in fact we were just sort of missing that sometimes and getting the other piece, and that's actually what's really good for schizophrenia. So, but it took a time to do that. We still have drugs now that work, but we don't know why. Another example of a compound that was in that similar nature is the compound for hair growth. What's it called? For Rogaine. There you go. Rogaine was discovered. Yeah. Rogaine was discovered because a laboratory fellow didn't follow the rules, wasn't wearing his gloves when he was supposed to, and spilled some on the back of his hand. And he noticed a couple days later that the back of his hand got really hairy where he'd been spilled on. It's the wrong place, of course, but if he hadn't have made that spill, we wouldn't have had that compound, which works for some people. So. But it was an accidental discovery. And, of course, when they did that, they had no idea why it worked. It's, again, a similar sort of thing for some of the other compounds that are very popular now. We discovered that they worked when we were investigating from something completely different. Then we had to figure out how do they work. So, again, there's a lot of biochemistry, biology, et cetera, in here. So what the mechanism of action is. Okay, and then we have to get to this trade-off, that anything you give somebody that has a desirable effect almost always, always has some undesirable effect when at certain doses. So you can think of the example of water. Water is good for you if you drink it in small quantities, you know, up to a couple, 4 liters a day at most for being healthy. On the other hand, if you take somebody and you submerge them in water and keep them there for a while, it's deadly. It's the same thing with any compound. Again, you know, salt. A little salt is good. If somebody force feeds you salt, you'll die of dehydration. Every compound has its trade-off between a range in which ideally it's safe and effective, or at least safe, and a range where it's not, and there's this similar curve usually going in the other direction of where it's effective. And so we need to quantify the safety and toxicity of compounds so you have curves going both ways. And ideally, the compounds you want to find are compounds like aspirin. Aspirin is essentially impossible to take enough aspirin to overdose on aspirin because its toxicity curve is so shallow. And the effective curve is pretty steep, so you only have to get a certain amount of aspirin to get most of the effect. And because those two curves are so different, then you have aspirin is a very nice drug, which again, people had to work a lot of time on to figure out how it worked. And we're still discovering mechanisms by which it worked. I think about 2 years ago, they disproved that one of the ways that they thought it worked did work and found a new way. So this is still happening. Okay, so for a given compound of action, again, you have to quantify the safety and toxicity. And oftentimes, what you discover is the first thing you found, the first chemicals you made, they'll do what you want, but they also do lots of things you don't want. They're too toxic, or as soon as they a certain dose can never get particular high enough strength, etc. So we go in lots of circles. Okay, so here's the trade-off. Once you know those two pieces, then you need to determine which dose is both effective and safe. And there's that trade-off again. For a cancer drug, you're willing to take a lot more of a safety hit to get efficacy than you are with the drug for headaches. Okay, so once you've got the drug, okay, so now how do you get it to people? How do you administer it? And how often do you administer it? Okay, so if you had to take aspirin by injecting yourself with the raw compound every 6 hours, would you use aspirin for headaches? No. No. On the other hand, again, if you're treating cancer, you want to give people intravenously? Yeah. So there's an awful lot of work that goes into, okay, how do we get this into the body? Can it get in through the gut? Does it have to go in through the blood system? Can it go in through the skin? Can we, you know, rub it on? How do we get it in there? Okay, what's the dosing mechanism? So one of the things that's been a really good seller for Pfizer in recent years is this new formulation of Zithromax. So Zithromax is an antibiotic that's very broad spectrum and is pretty potent. The original formulation you had to take for like 10 days, you know, twice a day for 10 days. Then they got that down to once a day by looking at the formulation. Then they've managed a couple of years ago to get it down so you take four pills over 3 days. Two the first day, one the second, one the third, something like that. They've recently, and are introducing to the market coming up this year, is one dose for your antibiotic. Now, with many things, like antibiotics, how often you have to take it determines how well people will follow the doctor's directions to take the drugs. So if you can get an antibiotic, which people tend to stop taking when they start feeling better, before they've killed all the organism, that's a big problem. So if you can get to one dose, that's a big improvement. On the flip side, an area where there's a lot of problems with compliance is with injected insulin. So people with diabetes who are insulin dependent have to inject the insulin because you can't get it into the digestive system. A patch on the skin won't get it in. And so we have a lot of problems with people not managing their sugar well enough because, so you're out at a party. You know, everybody's dressed up nice. All the ladies are in their slinky dresses and all the guys are in their tuxes. It's time for your insulin. It's not socially acceptable to sit down at the table, pull out your syringe, roll up your sleeve, swab yourself, and give yourself a stick. That's not socially acceptable. So people will skip it and then get into trouble because their sugar is not well dealt with. So that's another issue with getting things in. How do we get them in? And one of the reasons I bring this up is Pfizer has a new medication, a new way of delivering insulin, like an inhaler. So people can just inhale it. An inhaler is much more socially acceptable than a needle. It's also a lot less painful. And so people, hopefully, and the trials have demonstrated this, that people are much more willing to take and manage their insulin better, the sugar levels with insulin better, if it's an inhaler rather than injected. Now, of course, there are some side effects. Putting things in through your lungs generally means your lungs aren't quite as good at doing the normal things. So there's a trade-off there. You know, people with lung disease should not use an inhaler for taking medications, except the ones for treating lung disease, right? Anyway. Okay, so then how do we manufacture this? So we know where to put it into the body. Now we've got to manufacture it. So one of the fun things that I don't get to work on, except I got little pictures of, little pieces of over time, is, okay, so where do most people keep their medications? Most people keep their medications in the bathroom, okay? If you were going to pick a place in your house where any compound was most likely to decay as quickly as possible, where would that place be? The bathroom. Why? It's hot and wet. And that's a terrible place to put medications, but everybody puts them there. So one of the jobs that Pfizer has is formulating the pills. So if we're going to give you aspirin, pure aspirin is a little too potent to tip it in the pill, so we need to put something else in there so that you're not trying to pick out grains with a tweezer. So we have to bulk it up a little bit so it's in a convenient shape, and to protect it from being degrading in the environment, from humidity, from the temperature, etc. So there's formulation issues, and we have to do experiments and things to determine stability over time. We have to figure out how to manufacture these things, and as Dora was mentioning earlier, scaling up from something you can do in a little vial in a lab, that's almost a completely different world than what you do in a vat the size of a room. They're related because the chemistry is the same, but the probabilistic sorts of things that are happening and the uniformity of temperature and pressure become very much different. And so it's very hard to scale things up, and that's another area of research. Statistical process control, making sure that every time a pill comes out of the machine, it's within certain reasonable limits. And you might be surprised how wide those are. Manufacturing design issues. Okay, we can manufacture it this way and get the properties we want, but it's exceptionally expensive or difficult or time-consuming. Can we find less expensive ways of doing that? Okay, so up to this point, say we've got all this stuff done, then we come to the hard part. And it doesn't actually seem that it ought to be that way, but it is the way. This is the demonstrating that these things are safe and effective. So if you take an average compound that was developed and deployed, say, this year from a pharmaceutical company, it costs between $800 million and $1.1 billion to bring a drug to market. Okay. Doing this is expensive. And almost all of the cost, like 80% of the cost, is in this stage, where the company has to say, okay, we're going to try giving it to healthy volunteers to make sure it doesn't make them sick. Okay, now we're going to try giving it to sick people who have the problem, make sure it doesn't make them sicker. Now we have to give it to people who have the problem to demonstrate it actually helps. And we have to give enough to them that it makes that we don't have side effects that are relatively rare popping out, etc. This is the really expensive part. And as I mentioned, the FDA has shifted, so you still have to prove that your drug does what it says it does. We have to put a lot more effort now into proving that it doesn't do things it's not supposed to. And the American FDA is very conservative on that. Other countries have different balances between the safety and the efficacy issues. So one of the things that we're working hard on and that comes back into, well, I'll come back and ask some questions about bring some data mining things in there later. So I'm slightly different tack now. So what are the approaches to doing data mining? How much time do I have? I have 15 minutes. Okay. So different approaches to drug discovery. The accidental. I spilled it on my hand and it grows hair. I give people this drug that's really bad at this, but it really turns out to do something even better than we thought it would. This actually, an awful lot of things come into that category. You know, who was the person who thought up that if you take the bark off a specific kind of tree and eat it, it would cure your headache? Okay, you know, people go around nibbling on trees. I don't know. Anyway, these are sort of accidental. Sorry, what? Yeah. There's the experimental, I have an idea, let's try it and see. So the first one is the serendipity. The second one is, I have an idea, I'll try it. But those ideas aren't necessarily based on science at all. Or they're based on sort of pseudoscientific ideas. There's a lot of drugs that we have now that have a very long history. Like aspirin has been known for a couple of thousand years at least, 2,500. And there are other compounds that are likewise been known for a long time, but the theories that were used to invent them, to come up with them, were false. I mean, the theory of the humors about different blood, good blood and bad blood in your body, and various things that would cause you to lose blood and then would help you. Well, they helped you, but not because they caused you to lose blood. Things like that. There's a search mechanism, which actually Pfizer has been exceptionally successful at. A lot of our antibiotics, it turns out that in soil, different bacteria create chemicals to kill off all the other bacteria so they can have can compete and use the resources. It turns out that a number of Pfizer's antibiotics were discovered by just taking lots of dirt, extracting, mixing it with water essentially, extracting all the stuff we knew wasn't important, and trying it on cell samples and seeing if it killed bacteria. And we, for a long time, Pfizer would pay you a certain fee for soil that you collected from somewhere in the world we didn't already have soil. And we did that for like 20 years and came out with like 8 different classes of compounds for antibiotics. But this was this based on it was based on some theory that, you know, the theory of the bacteria, but it's not based on any theory about how bacteria work mechanistically. So this is the sort of the search method. Keep trying things that are sort of, you have an idea where there might be something good and find something. There's a bottom-up approach, which is more science-based generally, where, and this is sort of the classic thing that we did in physics and chemistry and other places. We take the, some system, in this case it being, you know, the human body or a specific type of cell, and try to break it down into the smallest pieces we can, understand the small pieces, and then try changing or inactivating or upgrading how one of those pieces works and hope that it does what we want to the whole system. Come back to the problem with that in a minute. There's top-down, which is, okay, we have this big system. We have certain inputs to the system as a whole. We can study them, try to figure out what the relationship is, and try to manipulate them. And, of course, both of these are amenable to the data mining approach. Of course, actually using all the different samples of dirt is another form of data mining, but sort of a pun. Then there's the hybrid approach, which is what happens in reality, which is mostly a mixture of all the above, and trying to use the best thing we can, but not doing it in a very systematic approach generally. I mean, we try, but because it's, each of the components of the system is an individual group or research group team or a person, there's no sort of overall clear mechanism. Then there's the system of biology approach. So this is sort of a schematic, but so what is systems biology? This is a pretty good definition. It's the conceptual integration of different kinds of experimental data together with relevant domain knowledge to create holistic and predictive models of biological systems. At which, the end of that, you don't know a lot more than you did when you started. So here's an attempt to sort of explain a little better. So it's an attempt to have a unified structure in which a lot of different data about what's going on in the system at low level can be combined together and interpreted in a context that looks at the system as a whole and how those pieces work together to make the system work and what you can do to respond to perturbations or make perturbations that do what you want. So the idea is, instead of looking at all the little pieces individually, to try to understand how they work together to form systems. And here comes the sort of first data mining question. In order to do this unified structure, you have to have all the pieces. Okay, this is actually a big problem. How do we encourage collection of the relevant domain knowledge in machine-accessible form? So there are some efforts in this direction, but it's still very incomplete. Most of the time, if you want to find out how a particular gene works, you go and you do a PubMed search, and you find a list of articles, and if you want to find the details, you pretty much have to go and you can use some advanced text mining techniques, which give you so-so answers, or you can go and read the articles, which gives you pretty good answers, but it's slow and time-consuming. So this is one question. Another question is, okay, so within Pfizer, we do hundreds of experiments a day. We've been doing this for years and years and years. We've got hundreds of thousands of experiments we've run on all sorts of different subjects, and there's a pretty good bet that anytime you want to run an experiment, there's been some experiment done before that's informative about some piece of this, whether it's the variability of the cell system or informative about certain pathways or mechanisms or certain compounds that do or don't work. A big problem is just finding those. How do you know that somebody ran the exact same experiment in a different part of the company last year? At the moment, we don't. And that's actually a big problem. That's when we get people together in a group and we start talking about what people did, we'll sometimes have two people from two different groups in two different parts of the corporation working on the same problem come and present experiments that are just different enough you can't combine the data. Because they measured them on different timescales or with different instruments or on different organisms. But if they'd known they were working on the same thing, at least they could have, you know, made their experiments compatible so they combined the data. Or even better, only doing one of the two experiments. Or, of course, the best answer is you discover somebody already ran the experiment and they ran it well enough, you can just use it. You don't have to do anything more. So I actually have a variant on the definition of system biology. And this is sort of a three-way definition that sort of captures where I sort of live in the world, because I sort of cross lots of boundaries. So I'm a statistician with a degree in computer science who works in a pharmaceutical company and has an academic appointment, and who sometimes builds infrastructure, sometimes does methodology, does data analysis. So I cross a lot of boundaries, and this is my personal definition of what system biology is. So it's the attempt to understand the behavior of biological systems. So that's the first definition we talked about. It's also a systematic approach to the study of biology. This is a place where we've got a weakness at the moment. Currently, most approaches are driven within specific domains by people pursuing problems that are of specific interest to them. They're sort of sequenced from the last problem they worked on. And this is oftentimes done in the absence of information that's what's going on in other domains that's relevant, or in other research groups that's relevant. And we have a certain system for disseminating information. But if you've noticed lately, every area is doing something on gene expression. If you want to find out what's going on in the world of gene expression, you would have to, you want to find out all the papers on gene expression this month, you'd have like 10,000 papers to look at. There's no way for any one person to do that mentally. So we've got to develop systems for helping this. We need better models to help us determine what areas need more explanation. So earlier we had some talks about some models that combine different scales. One of the things that's really neat about those models is you can use them to predict which things might happen, but actually to invalidate your predictions and to say, okay, if we do this, we change the media in which our cells are growing. In our simulation, this is what happens. In real world, when we do that, something completely different happens. Okay, how do we change that? What do we do about that? You can actually, because you have a mathematical, statistical, computational model, you can actually go back and say, okay, what part of the systems don't match the reality? And then you have good questions to go forward and pursue. Now, these are things that we've always been doing, but we haven't been doing in a systematic way. So the third piece is the development of software systems to support the process of performing biology. Notice that that doesn't say for performing data analysis. Data analysis is a small segment of the process. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to try to get to a little other information. Just one thing that I want to point out is one of the things that's driving the move to systems biology is the fact that we can now measure so many small pieces all at the same time that we can get lost in the pieces. That the reason nowadays that people come to my group and say, help me with this problem, I need a statistician, is because when they do what they normally do, they get 5,000 answers back. Okay, 5,000 answers is too many answers. If what your question is, which gene is most important for changing the metabolic rate of cells so we can increase the metabolic rate and have people burn fat while sitting around doing nothing. And you do an experiment and you get back 5,000 yes answers, okay, that's almost as good as no answers. And there's a lot of work that has to be done there. So this is one of the things that's driving the move to systems biology, to try to deal with these things as systems rather than individual units. So I'm going to do an outline here real briefly. How much more time? About five? About three. Oh, well, I guess we won't get to all the questions. So this is an outline of the pharmaceutical research process. This is very similar to almost any scientific research process. And I think that in writing this out, we have the opportunity to look at it and to say, where do we have strengths? Where do we have tools? Where do we have the mathematics and the statistical models to do a good job, and where don't we? So I'm going to outline it real quick. So the first one is, at least in the pharmaceutical industry, is what decision needs to be made. So almost always we're in a position where we need to decide whether we're going to try this compound in another experiment or not, whether we're going to pursue a specific disease area or not, whether we're going to try to market this drug or not. So we start off with the need to know how to act. So that's so we need to state the problem. We then need to figure out what we need to know in order to make a good decision. So first define the question, second define what we need to know to answer that. That's determining the necessary knowledge. That actually is a problem for which there are almost no tools. And it's a hard problem. What do we need to know in order to make a good answer? Another one. What information is needed in order to generate this knowledge? So there's layers here. So there's knowledge. How a system works is knowledge. You may need to have pieces of information to support that. So for instance, if I give you a model for how a cell works, but I don't give you any of the coefficients that tell you how the different pieces interact over time, the model isn't all that much use. You still need to have some specific data items. Those items themselves aren't of much practical use until you synthesize them together to make knowledge, but there's still the layer there. So what do I need to know? What information is necessary? What data and information is necessary to make that knowledge possible? What information do we have already? So this is the problem of what experiments have been run within Pfizer that touch this topic. What information do we need to collect? Which answers don't I have? Which parameters aren't estimated well enough? Which parameters do I not know about? Which parts of the model don't work well enough? How do we obtain the information we need? So what experiment will give me the best bang for the buck for determining whether this compound that I just manufactured will be safe and effective in humans? Is it the fact that I don't understand how it's metabolized? Is it the fact that I don't understand the mechanism of action? Is it that I don't understand the pathways I'm targeting? So a whole bunch of different questions that go into there. And again, we generally don't have good tools for any of these steps that are before you ever design an experiment. Then we come to the point of planning the experiment. How do we collect that information? Of course, once you've got an experiment, then you can actually perform the experiment and you collect raw data. Almost always the raw data you collected isn't directly useful. It's not scaled or combined or it's not summarized, etc. So you have a data pre-processing stage. Once you sort of combine the data into some useful form, then you can perform statistical analysis. So we have lots of tools in the data pre-processing stage and the statistical analysis stage. And this is where most data mining focuses, naturally. And so we can analyze experimental data to get information. In the case of our gene expression assays, again, so we've got 46,000 genetic markers, RNA markers. We can pump it through the statistical analysis, find out that there's 5,000 that are statistically significant. We still have a problem. Now we have to mine our answers to determine what's really relevant. And that's another sort of data mining problem. It's not traditional data mining, but again, it's in the same realm of looking at a lot of data to try to extract key information. So generally what we need to do then is to integrate this set of 5,000 results into the structure of the biology, the systems, the models, to understand what's going on. Then we can draw some conclusions, and from those conclusions, we can actually make a decision. So we're out of time, but I really wanted to get to this sequence because I think that an awful lot of our work has been on the second half here, and that there are definite places where data mining approaches, statistical approaches, data storage approaches, etc., can make a huge impact on how well we do the science before we ever go into the laboratory. And that this is an area that there's a great need and lots of opportunities. And some of the problems are relatively simple, low-hanging fruit, and of course there are other very difficult ones.